Throughout the course of our life, we begin with many great endeavors. And oftentimes, with the greatest intentions and the highest expectations, we venture out on a journey or on a project thinking that this time it's really going to work well. And oftentimes, over the course of time, our best starts fizzle into poor finishes. Sometimes we wonder why. Many have stood at the altar with incredibly high expectations for a lifetime of romance and passion, of understanding and tenderness, only to find that somewhere along the way it fizzles to more of a survival and a let's get through this. Oftentimes, students begin a semester thinking, this time I'm going to grasp the elusive A and maybe even learn something along the way, only to find when finals roll around that great expectations become settling for that C. And oftentimes we sit in a job interview thinking, this is the one. If I just get this job, it fits me perfect, it's going to be the greatest. Only to wake up a few months later and find out that it's part of that four-letter word, W-O-R-K. And why is it that oftentimes in life we begin thinking that this is going to be the one, and we start out with such great expectations, but we finish so poorly in the process? Peterson makes these comments. He says, William Butler Yeats wrote a meditative poem on this theme in the persona of an old man looking back over his life and finding not a single story with a finish worthy of the start. He remembers a young man with talent and skill in the elegant sport of fly fishing who turns into a drunken journalist. He recalls a girl who had absorbed all the delicate spiritualities of Dante, but in the end ends up bearing children to an oafish dunce. He sketches a beautiful woman with a soaring vision of a better world, reduced to screaming angry slogans from some soapbox. And he writes these cynical lines. Some think it's a matter of course that chance should starve good men and bad advance. And over the course of life, I believe that many survive by simply lowering expectations. Starting out with great expectations and then finding along the way that life is not yielding what we had anticipated, so we simply lower our expectations. So oftentimes by the time we reach retirement age, there are no expectations because life seems to constantly deal a bad hand. Beginning with high hopes and finishing with no hopes. And in America, we've got a solution to that, and that's start over. And let's face it, marriage is going south, start over. Job isn't working, get a different one. School isn't producing what you want, you know, change your major. We just keep starting and starting and starting, and over the course of our life, we think sooner or later we're going to hit on something that's going to yield success. When we face these issues in our life, we run headlong into the same thing that David dealt with. And in the life of David, the man who would be king, we find that he hits a significant snag after his great beginning. And if you'll open your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 17, we're going to pick up with David's story where we left off last week after his incredible victory. And we're going to see the transformation that takes place in his life. And we're going to find a clue in this story that helps us understand how to maintain what we started in the beginning. In 1 Samuel chapter 17, we end with David going out to meet Goliath, that moment of fame which would be the beginning of his life and the end of the giant's life. And here is this young man moving out to conquer with a great imagination, God's imagination. And while he's going out to fight, we read in verse 55 what Saul and the leaders of the nation of Israel are actually doing. It says in verse 55, as Saul watched David going out. Now here's the king, and the king is watching while the kid goes out to fight his battle. As Saul watched David going out to meet the Philistine, he said to Abner, commander of the army, Abner, whose son is that young man? Abner replied, as surely as you live, O king, I don't know. The king said, find out whose son this young man is. As soon as David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul, with David still holding the Philistine's head. Whose son are you, young man? Saul asked him. David said, I am the son of your servant, Jesse of Bethlehem. The highest point in David's life so far, the greatest success, the best possible beginning. What's going to happen to David's beginning? Chapter 18, verse 1 says, after David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house. Now, Jonathan is the son of Saul, and Jonathan has been involved in all of this conversation. He would have been there when Saul put his armor on David, when Saul sent him out. He's watching the whole thing. When David returns, Jonathan has a reaction to David that's very positive. And Saul does initially. And so Saul conscripts him to come and be with him, to live in his house, to fight his battles. But this is not going to be long-lived. The tide will turn for David, and he's going to go from the hero in the story to the hunted in the story. Watch what happens in verse 5. Whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well, which is a pretty big deal for a young man to be promoted to the head of the army when you got all these old seasoned fighting veterans, and they're even happy with it. Everybody's happy with David. What a great start. Verse 6 says, and when the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and tambourines and lutes. As they sang, they sang. Here's their top 40 hit. Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. Now this is a completely side note, but ladies, be careful what songs you sing, especially the praise of other men, around your husband. Because men have a very fragile ego. And Saul doesn't like this at all. Notice what he does. Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. They have credited David with tens of thousands, he thought, but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? And that's a very important question that Saul is asking very early on. And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. Now, keep in mind that Saul has already been told by Samuel, the kingdom is going to be taken from you. It's going to be given to a man who has a heart after God, a man after God's own heart. It's going to be ripped from you. Your sons are not going to sit on the throne. And from the time that Saul heard that, he's been in this self-protective mode, trying to make sure that God's will is not done, and that Saul stays on the throne and his sons reign. And so he sees David as a significant threat. And we're going to see in the next couple chapters that six times he's going to try to kill David. Six times. Notice what happens in the next verse. Verse 10, the next day an evil spirit from God came forcibly on Saul, and he was prophesying in his house while David was playing the harp. As he usually did, Saul had a spear in his hand, and he hurled it, saying to himself, I'll pin David to the wall, but David eluded him twice. So Saul tries directly to kill David. On two different occasions, David's playing the harp in the house, and Saul picks up a spear and he throws it at him, and David gets away. He misses him. So when that doesn't work, those first two attempts, Saul tries plan B. You'll notice in plan B that he decides that he's going to use the Philistines and his daughters to kill David. In fact, in verse 17, Saul said to David, here is my daughter Merab. I will give her to you in marriage, only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord. For Saul said to himself, I will not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that. You know, why should I be the one who kills the giant killer? Let the Philistines do that. So he promises his daughter in marriage to David if David will go fight his battles. And David goes out to fight his battles. He survives, but when it comes time to marry the king's daughter, Saul marries her off to someone else. But Saul has another daughter, and he's going to use her. So the third attempt is the Philistines, and the fourth attempt starts in verse 20. Now Saul's daughter Michal was in love with David, and when they told Saul about it, he was pleased. I will give her to him, he thought, so that she may be a snare to him, and so that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So Saul said to David, now you have a second opportunity to become my son-in-law. And Saul devises a plan. He says, David, you know, I don't really want any money for my daughter. I don't want any dowry. I don't want any land holdings. I know you don't have anything. All I want is revenge on my enemies. And he says, David, I need you to kill 100 Philistines and bring back the bloody proof that you've killed them. And if you'll do that, then you can have my daughter in marriage. Now, Saul's thinking to himself, you know, 1 out of 100, you know, at least 1 out of 100 can kill David. I mean, he may have good odds throwing that stone with a slingshot. He may have killed the giant. That was luck. But 1 out of 100, he's going to die. Well, you know what David does? He goes out and kills 200 of the Philistine soldiers, and he brings back proof. And Saul tries again. But in this case, with the Philistines, the fourth attempt fails as well. And so Saul is very, very unhappy. Verse 28 says, when Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that his daughter Michal loved David, Saul became still more afraid of him, and he remained his enemy the rest of his days. Chapter 19, verse 1, Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. So now he's directly telling all the people in the palace, I want you to kill David. And we see in this chapter that Jonathan goes to bat for David, gets Saul to repent. And Saul actually brings David back into the house and says, David, you know, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be trying to kill you. I've only done it 4 times, but, you know, I shouldn't try to kill you. And come on back. And David does. I mean, David is incredibly loyal to Saul. David comes back. And notice what happens again, verse 9 of chapter 19. But an evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand. While David was playing the harp, Saul tried to pin him to the wall with a spear, but David eluded him as Saul drove the spear into the wall. For the third attempt with the spear, now Saul tries to kill him again. And so David flees. This is attempt number 5. And look what happens in verse 11. Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and to kill him in the morning. Now he sends assassins to his own house. But Michal, David's wife, warned him, if you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed. So Michal let David down through a window, and he fled and escaped. Then Michal took an idol and laid it on the bed, covered it with a garment, and put some goat's hair on its head. And when Saul sent the men to capture David, Michal said, he is ill. Then Saul sent the men back to see David and told them, bring him up to me in his bed so that I may kill him. I guess among assassins there was some kind of a code that you didn't kill people on sick days. But Saul says, yeah, we're going to break the code. We're going to kill him on a sick day. And so then they go into the house and they find out that he's not there, that what's actually in the bed is a fake. And so 6 times Saul tries to kill David. Now he goes from being the savior of the people to being the enemy of the king. And Saul is trying to do him in. Now what do you think David is feeling about this time? Well, we see in chapter 20, verse 1. Then David fled from Naoth at Ramah and went to Jonathan and asked, what have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he is trying to take my life? Those words are words of absolute despair. It's the guy in the company who's served well, done everything the bosses ask, come up with all the great patents, all the great ideas, making it successful, and his boss is still trying to find a way to get rid of him. And he can't understand. You know, I've done everything I should have done. How in the world could I be treated this way? What in the world is going on? In Psalm 7, David expresses his lament at this time. And I love Eugene Peterson's modern translation of it, so I'm going to share that with you. David says, Yahweh God, I am running to you for dear life. The chase is wild. If they catch me, I'm finished. Ripped to shreds by foes fierce as lions. Dragged into the forest and left unlooked for, unremembered. In the second stanza, Yahweh, if I've done what they say, betrayed my friends, ripped off my enemies, if my hands are really that dirty, then let them get me, walk all over me, leave me flat on my face in the dirt. Third stanza, he says, stand up, Yahweh, pit your holy fury against my furious enemies. Wake up, God, my accusers have packed the courtroom. It's judgment time. Take your place on the bench, reach for the gavel, throw out the false charges against me. I'm ready, confident in your verdict, innocent. And then in the last stanza, David expresses his hope. He says, see that man shoveling day after day, digging, then concealing his man trap down that lonely stretch of road? Go back and look again. You'll see him in it, head first, legs waving in the breeze. See what's happened? Mischief backfires. Violence boomerangs. Now, how could David say that with confidence? How could a man who started out so well and now is in jeopardy of losing his life, how could he have such confidence that God was going to take care of him and God was going to protect him? I would suggest to you that there was one factor in David's life that made all the difference in the world, and I would suggest to you that there will be one factor in your life that will make all the difference in the world as to whether you finish what you start well. And that factor is the Jonathan factor, the friendship factor. Notice Jonathan moves from strangers to friends in chapter 18, verse 1. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. When you get home this afternoon, read through all of the account of all these chapters, and you'll find that there's one consistent person. Every time David was in a bad spot, Jonathan stepped in, and Jonathan provided what David needed to not only get through his difficulty, but to do it well and to do it successfully. Now, I want you to notice a couple things right here in this verse. It says that Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. Now, the word love there is very important to note, because the Hebrew word for love here is different than what we normally think of. Normally, when we think of love, we think of an overwhelming emotion that just comes over us that we can't help ourselves with. And the Hebrew word ahav here, which is translated love, means anything but an overwhelming emotion that comes over us that we can't help ourselves with. In fact, this word is a volitional word. It literally means to prefer or to choose or to select. Now here's what the text is saying. The text is saying, Jonathan, when he looks at David and sees that David stepped up and killed the giant, which his father was too chicken to do, which he was unwilling to do, which everybody was unwilling to do, and he saw what David did, you know what he said? He said, this guy is my guy. He's my man. I pick him. I choose him. I want to be with him. I want to see him advance. I am one with him. And notice what the text says. It says that he loved him as he loved himself. In other words, what it's saying is that he said, whatever is good for me is good for this guy. Whatever I want for me, I want for him. Whatever glory comes my way, I want that glory to come his way because he's worthy of it. He deserves it. And Jonathan picks David, chooses him, and makes a commitment to be his friend. Now, this is very opposite of the kinds of friendships that we see today. You know, frequently you'll see kids that call each other friends and, you know, they're actually willing to come out right out and say what they think about their friends, you know. The girl walks in with a new outfit, and what do her friends say? I hate you for that. You got a new outfit and I didn't. Or, you know, the guy scores all the points on the basketball court and, oh man, I just hate you. You had such a good game. What is that? That's the same thing that you feel when your neighbor pulls in with his new automobile and you look over and you go, I hate that guy. He's always getting something that I want. Here's what Jonathan is saying. Jonathan is saying, I want him to have everything that I have. Any good blessing that I would wish upon myself, I wish that upon David, and I want to make sure that that happens. I want to make sure that he gets what I desire. Now, the interesting thing in this story is the hero in this section of the story is not David. The hero in this section of the story is Jonathan. Jonathan is the one who steps out and becomes the anchor, steps out and becomes the light, steps out and becomes the support, the encouragement, the life-changing relationship that David is going to need to get through his difficulty. And what I find in our culture is that there are very few people, men or women, that actually have that kind of a relationship in their lives. And you know what I find? There are very few men and women in our culture that actually will commit themselves to be that kind of a friend for someone else. In fact, the playwright the novelist Thomas Wolfe, in his book The Anatomy of Loneliness, sums it up with this statement. He says, "The whole conviction of my life now rests upon the belief that loneliness, far from being a rare and curious phenomenon peculiar to myself and a few other solitary men, is the central and inevitable fact of human existence." You know, he's saying, for a while I thought it was just me and men like me. But now I'm beginning to discover that that's the way it is for almost everybody. And what I would suggest to you is friendship is as spiritual and as necessary as any of the other disciplines that God calls into your life. It's as essential as prayer. It's as essential as time in the Word. It's as essential as sharing the gospel. Friendship is a necessary component of life. And to have a biblical friend who holds you and guides you and leads you, who's there with you, who stands beside you, is one of the reasons why people end well, why they finish well, why they survive with what they started. And so this morning, what I want to do is I want to move from David's story to my story and look at three principles of true friendship that were applicable in Jonathan's situation with David and are applicable for us today. And the first principle is this: a true friend elevates your success to his or her priority. A true friend elevates your success to his or her priority. Let me state a very significant principle about starting and keeping friendships. I'm going to put it up here so you can see it. All true friendships begin with the commitment to be a friend, not just to have a friend. And this is where I think it always breaks down. All true friendships begin with a commitment to be a friend, not just to have a friend. And unfortunately, my fear is, and I'll give you my fear right out front on this message, is everybody sits there and goes, "Oh yeah, you know, I wish there was a Jonathan in my life. I wish Jonathan would come along and help me and encourage me, and you know, I just don't know why people aren't more like that, and I just wish that people would be friends to me, and I just don't understand it. You know, my whole life I've been waiting for someone to show up." You know what? The time is now for you to be a friend. What's interesting to me in this passage is David is the kid. Jonathan is older. Jonathan is heir to the throne. David's heir to nothing. And the mature, older, well-positioned individual reaches down and takes a hold of the younger guy and says, "I'm going to make sure that you succeed. I'm going to elevate your success to my priority." And here you have the older reaching out to the younger. And what I would suggest to you is that you'll never have a friend, you'll never have a real, live, successful, God-honoring friendship until you make a commitment that you're going to be that to somebody else. You know, people say to me, "Well, you know, I had lunch with a couple people, and, you know, I showed up at small group, and I did that a couple times, and, you know, nobody befriended me." Well, what's the obvious question? Come on. Come on, you know this, don't you? I just said it, didn't I? What's the obvious question? Who did you befriend? Who did you reach out to? Who did you prefer? Who have you elevated in your priority system? It's very interesting. Twice in this passage, both in chapter 18, verse 3, and in chapter 20, verse 17, Jonathan says that he loved David as he loved himself. Jesus Christ gives us the same standard. Remember when Jesus is asked, you know, what's the greatest commandment? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength, and to love your neighbor how? As yourself. In other words, you really haven't loved until you've elevated somebody else's priority, someone else's success, to the same level as your own. Paul said the same thing to husbands. Husbands, love your wives as what? As your own bodies. He goes on to say, you know, no man ever takes his body and neglects it. I mean, he's going to feed it. He's going to take care of it. He's going to make sure it gets enough sleep, make sure it gets enough entertainment, especially during March Madness. He's going to make sure all that good stuff flows in his direction. You know what Paul's saying? Make sure that you treat your wife in the same way, that her needs get met, that you feed her, that you love her, that you prefer her above yourself. And until we actually elevate someone's priority to a level that is equal with our own, we have not really chosen them as a friend. In this passage, we see that Jonathan does two things. First of all, he sees the potential in David. And a true friend sees your potential. A true friend sees your potential. When Jonathan looks at David, the giant killer, he says, "This is the guy. Man, this guy's got potential. He's going places, and I want to make sure he gets there." Which is the second principle, is he sacrifices to make you succeed. He sacrifices to make you succeed. Now, I want to show you how great a sacrifice Jonathan laid down for David. And if you'll turn over to chapter 20, you know, Saul's right in the throes of trying to kill David. David is trying to figure out, you know, is he going to try to kill me today or is he going to love me today? Because Saul was pretty fickle on this whole deal. And so they devise a plan where David doesn't show up for the feast, where he goes out and hides in the field, and Jonathan shows up at the feast to see Saul's reaction. And after 2 days of David not being there, Saul gets incredibly angry and asks where David is. And we see in verse 30, it says, Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, you know your dad's mad at you when he calls your mother names. Don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die." And Jonathan says, "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" Jonathan asked his father. But Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. If his father's willing to kill Jonathan, I mean, you know, because of his friendship, he's willing to kill David. Jonathan, understanding the level of his father's hatred, goes to bat for David, protects David, stands by David, because Jonathan wants David to succeed, and he's willing to sacrifice his own position to make sure David succeeds. The second principle of true friendship is that a true friend encourages you with God's perspective. A true friend encourages you with God's perspective. I want you to turn over to chapter 23. Chapter 23. David's still running from Saul. Saul is still trying to kill him. And we see the last encounter between David and Jonathan. Their very last encounter together. In chapter 23, starting in verse 15, it says, "While David was in Horesh, in the desert of Ziph, he learned that Saul had come out to take his life. And Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God." Now that's an incredible thing. He says he helped him find strength in God. Now, the way this is stated in the text is so appropriate to relationships. He didn't just come out there and say, "Hey, you know, buck up or look on the bright side." It says he helped him find it. In other words, it was something that Jonathan was willing to stay with David and look for it. Because in David's economy, he was in the desert. He was under the king's ban. He had assassins looking for him. The king was out there. And rather than Jonathan just walking in there and saying, "Hey, Dave, you know, the sun's shining. You know, be happy. Don't worry." The two of them together began to work through and look for until they found strength. And Jonathan was with him there to help him do that. In addition, Jonathan points him to the true source of strength. He points him to the promises of God. It says that Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. You know, there was no strength in the circumstances. There was nothing obvious there that he could cling to. There was nothing that he could depend on. And so where did they look? They looked to God. And I'm not sure what that conversation was all about, but I'm sure that Jonathan reminded David of the day when Samuel came and poured the oil on his head and said, "You will be king." I'm sure that Jonathan reminded him of the day that he put that stone in the sling and he brought down Goliath. I'm sure that Jonathan reminded him of all the battles that he was successful in. And Jonathan is reminding him of all the ways that God took care of him. And every single person needs a relationship with someone that will point you to the bigger picture, that will show you God in the midst of your difficulties, show you the ultimate source of strength. In your friendships, do you point people to God? In your friendships, do people know what God's perspective is? Because when they get down, or when they find difficulty, you enter in and you talk to them about what God's thinking, about what God's doing. You recall the past, see the hand of God at work. The final principle that we see in this passage is that a true friend establishes your connection with commitments. A true friend establishes your connection with commitments. Notice what happens in verse 17 of chapter 23. Jonathan goes on to say, "Don't be afraid," he said. "My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this." The two of them made a covenant before the Lord. Then Jonathan went home, but David remained at Horesh. In essence, Jonathan, having recognized the hand of God in David's life, says, "Listen, you know, here's my robe, here's my sword, here's my tunic, here's my crown. You know, just to be there beside you when you succeed, to be your right-hand man, to be coming off the bench for you, that's my goal." I mean, what an incredible hero. What an incredible friend. That's Jonathan. But I want you to notice that Jonathan and David have a clear understanding of what their commitments are. Notice that true connection always involves, first of all, clear communication. It always involves clear communication. Jonathan and David are not just sitting out there on a rock grunting. You know, the male mode of communication. They're verbalizing. They're talking. Jonathan is telling David, "Listen, David, you're going to be king, and I'm going to be beside you." He's opening his mouth and he's telling David, "Hey, David, this is our relationship. This is what it's all about." Secondly, we see that in this setting, true connection always involves real commitments. Jonathan makes a covenant with David. In fact, several times through the section, we find out that Jonathan makes promises to support David. And one of the most important things that you can do in a friendship is talk about your relationship, talk about what it means, and then make promises to one another. It's absolutely critical. I'll give you a personal example. A number of years ago, in my pastor's covenant group, I meet with a group of pastors once a month for accountability. In my pastor's covenant group, one of the guys raised the issue of a pastor that got a divorce, and he said, "You know, this guy's wife had been talking to him for a long time, and he wasn't listening to his wife." And we talked about, you know, what can you do to ensure that you listen to your wife, especially if you are going off the deep end? You know, how do you listen to your wife? And so we thought about it, we prayed about it, we talked about it for a long time, and we each made a commitment that we would have a friend, that we would give permission for our wives to talk to this person. And so I called my best buddy, called him up on the phone. I said, "Hey, Danny, I need you to help me with something. I want you to make a commitment, a covenant, a promise to me that if my wife ever calls you and says, 'Danny, Tim's gone off the deep end,' that you would get on a plane and you would walk into my living room and you would sit me down and you would deal with me." And he prayed about it for a while, because that's a serious commitment. And after a couple weeks of us praying and talking about it, he made a commitment to me that he would do that. That he would get on a plane and that he would come and he would sit down and he would look me in the eye and slap me around and kick me or whatever it took to beat some sense into me. And then both he and his wife and Cindy and I sat down, and I told Cindy and he told his wife, "Listen, if there's ever a time when you think that we're off base and you need help and you can't get through, you go to Danny. You call Tim." And they promised each other, they made a covenant, they made a commitment to each other that they would go wherever it takes and do whatever it takes to get our attention. You know, in the absence of that, in the absence of a commitment, in the absence of two people who are in a relationship actually sitting down and defining what this commitment means to each other, we have a very, very shallow relationship. And Jonathan goes very public with David and he says, "David, this is what it means to me to be your friend." And they promise things to each other. Now, I know that everyone would love to have a Jonathan in their life. But let me tell you, what we need is a world of Jonathans. We need a world of men and women who will commit to do what Jonathan does. As you read through the story, the thing that just kind of stands out to you is that every time Saul attacks David with evil, Saul gets weaker and David gets stronger. And the reason why good overcomes evil in the life of David, the reason why he doesn't quit, the reason why he doesn't give up, the reason why he doesn't fizzle out, the reason why he doesn't disappear, is because throughout the story there is an individual, a friend, who comes, finds him, and keeps him tracking. Is there anybody that could say, man, I got a friend in you. You find me. You keep me tracking. And I'm going to finish well because of my relationship with you. That's what friendship is. Everybody needs to be a friend. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, I pray that you would give us a kind of heart that we would be dissatisfied with mediocre finishes to the point where we would love enough and care enough, stretch enough to find a brother or a sister that we can walk with. Father, I pray that life-changing relationships would be added to our spiritual commitments and that you would do an amazing work through Hill Country Bible Church as we covenant to be Jonathans and Davids with one another. For we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.